All right, so as I mentioned earlier, I will be talking about an analytical platform that has started to be explored in clinical toxicology, metabolomics, and proteomics. But I think there are no other groups, at least in the United States, that has been exploring this particular platform in non-target, when what we call as non-targeted analysis, for the purposes of actually deciphering new environmental chemical targets for environmental biomonitoring. So there are about 3,000 chemicals in the CDC's list that are considered high production volume chemicals, and those are chemicals that are produced or manufactured in the United States at about 1 million pounds a year. There are only about 300 chemicals of these 3,000 that are biomonitored each year. So what happens to the 2,700, you might ask? Well, they are not being biomonitored because there are no health concerns about them, but because there are no analytical methods to actually detect them in biological matrices. The traditional method of expanding the list of targets for biomonitoring is to come up with a priority list of chemicals that structurally mimic those that are already being biomonitored. So people invest money on, particularly on synthesizing a reference standard for that particular target. It usually takes about 3 to 6 months or even a year to develop a method. And unfortunately, so you can just imagine the cost, the time, and the effort that goes in method development. But unfortunately, after you have patiently developed the method, there's really no assurance that at the end of all your work, you will find that particular target in a biological matrix. So in some cases, all your efforts are wasted when you find out at the end of the line that it's not really relevant to actually target that particular chemical. So wouldn't it be nice, though, to be able to actually have the ability to actually be able to measure all potential chemicals in biological matrices even before you actually develop a method for targeted analysis? That was a dream a decade ago, but I think we do have a platform now that will allow us to do that. And I will briefly talk about that particular platform, time-of-flight mass spectrometry. So time-of-flight mass spectrometry is an analytical technique that is based on separation of molecules according to charge-to-mass ratio. Well, usually, the charge that we normally would be more interested on has a +1 charge. And so that in that particular case, that would be equivalent to the molecular weight of the chemical. So you can see you're measuring charge-to-mass ratio, and therefore molecules needs to be ionized in this particular technique. It's not a new technique. The first time-of-flight mass spectrometers have already been available in the 50s. But its application to biological matrices is currently recent. And usually, it comes in tandem with liquid chromatography or gas chromatography. You're all familiar with liquid chromatography tandem mass spectrometry, right? For targeted analysis, LCMS or mass spec. I think what most people think when they hear mass spec is LCMS, MS, or liquid chromatography tandem mass spectrometry. So here's a very simplistic block diagram for an LC mass spec. So you have usually at the front end you have an HPLC or a GC, which actually helps separating chemicals according to their polarity. What comes off of a GC or an HPLC is then forwarded to the mass spectrometer. The front end of a mass spectrometer is an ion source. I mentioned that mass spectrometers measures ions inside of molecules. So at the front end is that particular gadget that would allow you to ionize the molecules that you're trying to analyze. Those ions are then sorted according to their mass in what I will call here a mass analyzer. And each of those ions are then detected in what's usually similar to a scintillation counter, yielding the mass spectra of a compound that gives you an indication of the molecular weight of the parent ion, or the molecular weight of the intact molecule. In some cases, you can actually get the molecular weight of the daughter ions. In time-of-flight mass spectrometry, and again, this is a simplistic representation of time-of-flight mass spec, how do we actually separate the ions according to mass? In TOF-MS, what you would be measuring are all the ions that are coming out of your sample. That particular ion is then channeled to what's called a time-of-flight tube. Well, what is the basis for separation of these particular ions? All of these ions start at what's called a pulsar, okay? And what the pulsar does, okay, so when you ionize, you can either ionize in the positive or negative polarity, okay? You can only ionize for one particular polarity. So all these ions have the same polarity or same charge. They're either all positive or all negative, okay? Well, what the pulsar does is that it basically accelerates these ions by applying an electric charge, a voltage that has an associated potential energy to it. So all of these ions would experience the same potential energy, and therefore, when they're accelerated or flung into this what's called time-of-flight tube, they would have the same kinetic energy. Well, law of conservation of energy dictates that if all of these ions having different masses should have the same energy, then therefore they should have different velocities. And intuitively, we can easily say that the smaller the ion is, the lighter the ion is, then the faster it travels, right? And that's why you have here a separation of these different sizes of ions towards the end of its flight on the time of flight tube. Is it still clear? Good. All right, so in time of flight mass spectrometry, what you're actually measuring is the time of flight of the ion. And that is simply the time it takes for the ion to traverse this end of the tube to the detector, right? And as I've said, because time of flight is proportional, so time of flight is then proportional to the molecular weight of the ion. Well, current advances in the technology by which this time of flight mass spectrometer, so this is just a representation of one of time of flight mass spectrometers that are available in the market. This is from Agilent. The current advances in the technology of producing this instrument has allowed this particular instrument to have mass measurement at the sub 2 parts per million accuracy. What does that mean? And what is the implication of having that particular accuracy? Well, the high mass accuracy actually allow us to unambiguously assign a molecular formula to what is measured as an exact mass. Okay, let me elaborate further. Okay. When we talk about time of flight, the mass accuracy is usually measured in terms of mass error, okay? And what is mass error? Mass error is very simply expressed in this particular formula. It's the difference between the molecular weight of what was measured by the instrument and the theoretical molecular weight of the compound divided by the theoretical molecular weight or the exact mass of the compound multiplied by 1 million, and that's why it's parts per million. Right? So, for example, if the exact mass of a compound is 250.0000, and the machine was able to measure this at 250.0005, the mass error associated with that particular measurement is 2 parts per million. Okay? Well, it's clear here that if you have this level of accuracy, that means that the machine can actually measure, okay, molecular weight to the 4th decimal place accurate, okay, at a 0.0001 mass accuracy. Because you have molecular weight in the equation, depending on the molecular weight of the compound, the atomic mass unit error that is associated for 2 parts per million differ, right? For 100 gram per mole, that's about, or atomic mass unit, that's about 0.0002. Right? And then for 400, that's about 0.0008. I think it is safe to say that a lot of small molecules are actually in this particular range, and therefore it is safe to say that this particular technology has the ability to actually measure exact masses at the 0.00 or the 3rd or 4th decimal place. Well, okay, what are the consequences of having that mass accuracy? This is huge, and I'll show you why. These are two opioids, and I apologize, most of my examples are in clinical toxicology because that's how I started, and I like opioids. Who doesn't, right? All right, morphine and pentazocine have the same nominal mass, 285, 285 also for pentazocine, right? Your usual LC-MS, the single quads, will not be able to distinguish this. But because time of flight has the accuracy to the fourth decimal place, there's a huge difference between 0.2093 and 0.1365. Furthermore, okay, because of this high mass accuracy, what this technology allows us is to actually assign a particular molecular formula to what mass we're measuring, right? So this is an example. Say you have a measurement of 285.1365, and assuming that you have carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen only, okay? At nominal mass resolution, meaning that if you're accurate to the first decimal place, there are hundreds of formula that would fit this particular mass, okay? At 10 ppm accuracy, there are only 5 possible formula that would fit this particular mass. At 3 ppm, there are only 3. So these are the 3 particular formula that would fit this particular mass. At 3 ppm, only this particular formula would fit this particular mass. And so this is powerful. I've said that most TOF can actually deliver 2 parts per million accuracy. So in a sense, by just measuring the parent ion masses, you can actually assign a molecular formula. So in a sense, you can measure the chemical profile of a sample. So what is the usual methodology for this kind of technique? First, you do a full scan mass spectra, meaning every masses are measured by the machine. There's an algorithm that assigns exact masses and retention time to the chemicals. How am I doing in time? Okay. There's a deconvolution algorithm then that actually would assign the best formula match to the exact mass. And then, okay, so this is the targeted part of this non-targeted analysis. If you want to give a particular identity to your formula match, you need to create a database. But the advantage is you're not actually asking someone to synthesize reference standards for you. What you're doing is you're preparing your database. And the comprehensiveness of your database is only proportional to how diligent you are in actually compiling all the chemicals and the molecular formula assigned to it. So that particular database then can be used to query what would match the masses that you're measuring. For confirming that, so you will generate what's called compound hits. For generating then what the identities are, the real identities or confirmation of those compound hits, you would still, at the end, need a reference standard. You might ask, so what's the advantage? Well, the advantage is this. You're measuring biological matrices first before developing the method. So your chance of actually getting something that would actually be seen in the biological matrices has already been tested. Okay? Another advantage, in targeted analysis, okay, let's say for example, you did your measurement of environmental phenols now. In targeted analysis, you will only be measuring what you target for. For non-targeted analysis, let's say for example, your database now contains 500 chemicals, and in 5 years from now, you were able to expand it to 5,000 chemicals. Okay? For targeted analysis, to query something 5 years from now, you have to rerun your sample. Because you need to develop a targeted method for that. For time-of-flight mass spectrometry, you just have to query the data that you generated 5 years ago. So then you can ask a question. Okay, gee, I wonder if, say, this substitute for bisphenol A was present in my chemical in my samples already 5 years ago. Okay, that's powerful. In a sense, that would potentially eliminate archiving of samples, which we're learning is very, very difficult to do, especially if you're having a huge number of a large cohort. So, okay, just an illustration of what is done. So you have here, this is what was measured: retention time and masses. You generate the best formula match for the mass, and then for the database, you then query that particular mass with this database, okay? Or the database that you have for a particular chemical. We can discuss this in the question and answer. So this is not new in environmental chemistry. This has been done in Europe for determining unknown contaminants in water, pesticides in food, pharmaceuticals in wastewater, and emerging contaminants in environmental sample. But as I've said, this is the first time that we're doing it in biological matrices in environmental biomonitoring. So this is the typical protocol that you do. You create a database for your target chemicals. You run them on the TOF. You determine the detection frequencies of each chemical. You then rank the detection frequencies of each chemical. And depending on what you want the analysis for, you can be measuring novel chemicals. Therefore, you might just want to see detection frequencies of chemicals that are not being biomonitored yet by NHANES. So you can just rank them and select those chemicals to confirm, and then confirm and quantify those chemicals of interest by LC-MS/MS. Have we tested this? Yes, we did. We have two cohorts, and my collaborator Tracy Woodruff would actually present the results of our first pilot study. She's actually trying to discover new environmental chemicals to biomonitor in pregnant women. I leave the discussion of that particular part to her. Another cohort that we have actually tried this on is in the discovery of endocrine disruptors that can be linked to hypospadias. So hypospadias is a condition where there's a congenital defect in penile development. And so these are two different things. Here you're only looking for high-frequency chemicals. Here you're differentiating a control versus a disease state and seeing if there are chemicals that are unique to hypospadias. So very briefly, this is just a pilot study. So here's our cohort for hypospadias. We have 18 boys with hypospadias, and our controls are 9 boys undergoing circumcision. We screened for where there is already an association reported between phthalates and hypospadias. So what we screened for initially is hypospadias, but we thought, these are structurally similar to other endocrine disruptors like phenols, PBD, PCB metabolites, and acidic and phenolic pesticide. So the aim of this particular study is to compare chemical profiles and determine if there are the endocrine disruptors that can be associated to hypospadias. Two last slides. Okay, what's the result of that initial study? Okay. This is what we feared, that we won't see any difference between hypospadias. So what I'm seeing here is an example of the chemicals that we saw and their detection frequency. So 100% means we're seeing 4-octylphenol in 18 of 18 boys. And here for the control, 9 of 9 boys. Qualitatively, there's not much of a difference. But we have seen what we expect to see, like phthalates, for example. MEHP is a phthalate metabolite. Butyl diethyl phthalate is a phthalate. Bisphenol A, right? So we saw these results. We then said, maybe it's not just a qualitative difference. Maybe it's the quantitative difference. Maybe when you look at the peak areas of all these hits, then you would see that there is a difference. And this is my last slide. Okay, there are some chemicals, although the frequencies are a bit low, that are different. Like, for example, butyl paraben, there's a 3-to-2 ratio between hypospadias and control. MEOHHP, which is a phthalate metabolite, that's 2-to-1. And monobenzyl phthalate is 3-to-1. And this is more interesting. When we look at the peak areas, methyl paraben is 3 times higher in the hypospadias than the control. Parahydroxyphenone is 10 times higher than the control. And I'd just like to acknowledge all these people who are instrumental to this particular pilot studies. And with that, thanks for listening, and I would accept one question. we can have discussion later. No question? No one's interested?